Ready to connect with the investment community here in Cleveland? Want to learn about the people, events, projects, and firms that are making a difference? Want all that but feel like you don't have the time? This is the show for you. Welcome to Guardians of Finance. Brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland and hosted by Matt McLaughlin, portfolio specialist at Diamond Hill Capital Management, Guardians of Finance will provide you with a chance to foster deeper connections and know what is getting the attention of Cleveland's investment community. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head to guardiansoffinance.com where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland and attend an educational or social event and find volunteer opportunities. And now, here's your host, Matt McLaughlin.
Welcome to the Guardians of Finance podcast. I am your host, Matt McLaughlin. In this episode, we talk with George Mateo, Chief Investment Officer at KeyBank. George has worked for several prominent organizations in the Northeast Ohio investment community, and he shares his career journey with us. George also talks about his background and expertise implementing alternative assets into portfolios, as well as KeyBank's current market outlook. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode with George Mateo. George, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Just kind of jumping right in, looking at your background and your bio, you've worked for a couple firms here in Cleveland with some notable names. Which one's your favorite? No, that's a joke. Just kidding. We don't have to start off there.
Hey, Matt, we love all of our children, right? So let's just kind of call it equal, right?
I think someone told me we love all of our children, but we like ones much better. I don't know if that's true or not.
There's probably cyclicality in that too, right? So I don't know.
True, true. Well, maybe let's just start off from the beginning. Maybe just tell us a little about your upbringing. Where'd you grow up? I believe you're a Cleveland native, and kind of take us through your college age years.
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, I'm a boomerang twice in the sense that I was born and raised in Cleveland. My parents moved us away when I was in grade school, moved to Omaha, Nebraska, of all places, and then came back to finish high school in Solon, in the Cleveland area. Went to school down in Southern Ohio, started my career in banking for a while, moved to the investment business. And then I guess through my college years, shortly after that, I moved to Chicago and then came back a few years later. So like I said, I'm a boomerang twice over.
Sure. Any memories stand out from your childhood or early years of first financial memories or being intrigued with something? What kind of caused you to go down that path?
Well, I was really fortunate in the sense, Matt, that my father worked in the investment business and his father, my grandfather, was a management consultant of sorts. He worked for McKinsey. And I still remember almost vividly the two of them just kind of sitting around talking about the economy, talking about businesses and strategy. And it kind of intrigued me. And I remember also to this day pretty well, sometime around probably third or fourth grade, we were involved in a project that actually had to design a product and kind of sell it. And the product was soap. I mean, it was a really kind of pedestrian type of product, but we had the idea of what does people want is soap. And this kind of boring little project kind of turned out to be a really fascinating thing for me because we did all this quote unquote market research. We talked to every kid in school and kind of surveyed them what they found appealing about soap, which was a kind of silly thing to say, but it kind of intrigued my psyche around just market intelligence and consumer behavior. And that kind of got me hooked on the business world, oddly enough.
That's so interesting. So that was a school sponsored kind of program that made you think like that. That's so, I think that's great that at that young age that they made you kind of do something like that.
Yeah, it was intriguing. And I mean, I don't know exactly what turned me on to it, honestly, when I think back about it, but probably just, I guess, kind of rubbing off on being around my father and grandfather, who, as I said, would talk about markets and the economy and businesses. And I still remember leafing through my dad's editions of Business Week once in a while just to kind of see what was going on in the world. And not that I really understood everything, but it was just kind of intriguing to see how the world worked.
Sure, sure. Well, let's kind of start off where you're at now and maybe work backwards through your career. So maybe just tell everyone your role and the organization you work for and maybe go from there. We'll have some questions for there and then maybe work backwards on how you got there.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. So I'm currently the Chief Investment Officer for Key Wealth Management here in Cleveland, Ohio. We're about a $55 billion wealth management firm with offices around the country. Our team of about 30 people are the investment professionals that help design, execute, implement, think about investment strategy and solutions for our clients that really range from institutions to individuals and families. Our team is focused on providing security selection decisions, portfolio construction decisions, manager research ideas, and oftentimes we think about top-down views of the world and where investment strategy might be taking us.
Sure. Now, is Key an organization that you moved up through, or did you come to Key in the CIO role from somewhere else?
I was hired into Key Wealth as the CIO about 7 years ago. Previously to that, I was, I guess, the first full-time investment person at the Cleveland Clinic, which was developing their investment office in kind of the, I guess, early mid-2000s or so, and was really fortunate to work there at a really interesting time in their life cycle. So as that office was evolving, the opportunity arose to join Key and was recruited away. So that's how that came about.
Sure, sure. So it sounds like you've run a couple different investment offices, investment functions. Has your entire career been in manager research type roles, or were there other things that you started off in and developed into kind of what you are now?
I guess, Matt, there's probably four segments of my career that I can reflect upon. Early on, I was kind of really focused on security selection. Oddly enough, I was an equity research analyst for a while. Part of that, I had a stint in credit research. And actually, that was really formative in the sense that credit research really kind of taught me how to think about companies and really what their financials were telling us in terms of their overall financial health. So credit research, equity research, you know, kind of security selection was probably the first, I don't know, 7 or so years of my career. That then evolved into more of a portfolio management and soon thereafter, kind of more of a manager selection type of opportunity. And from that, it was then kind of moving, as you mentioned, within the Cleveland Clinic realm, thinking about more big picture things of portfolio construction, execution. Frankly, governance was a big part of that moment in my career. And more recently, it's been focused on leadership here at KeyBank.
It seems like quite a few of the people I talk to in your kind of roles or other similar roles, they kind of cut their teeth, if you will, in some of those maybe credit research or security selection or something that has to do with kind of analyzing companies. What took your career and put it on a different path? Was it just your interests started to wean somewhere else? Or was it more just opportunities come up that kind of take you down maybe a little different path than just becoming a bond picker for a portfolio?
Well, maybe I wasn't very good at it. I don't know exactly what that might tell you, or maybe people might take me up on that idea. But I guess I like the idea of thinking about things as the sum of the whole as opposed to individual parts. I really did enjoy security research, but I did realize, I think at some point in my career, that there were people, frankly, that were better at it than me. And there are people that are much more skilled at it. And it is a highly specialized craft. And I really do have a lot of admiration for people that spend their time thinking about individual securities and thinking about company strategy in a very detailed micro way. Something I read, I don't exactly remember what it was, but at some point along my career, I guess the idea around portfolio construction, asset allocation, it was probably around the time that Dave Swenson wrote his really famous book now around portfolio management. That really kind of turned me on to the idea of thinking about things as a much larger sum of the parts as opposed to individual distinct asset classes or even securities. And from there, it really kind of sent me thinking about overall portfolio construction, like I said, thinking about kind of the overall macro view of the world and having at least a point of view. Not to say that I think I can precisely predict where the economy is going with any great foresight or precision, but I think having a view is important when you think about investment strategy. And that really kind of turned me on to overall notions of a portfolio construction, like I said, and portfolio design was really more interesting and probably more suited to my skill set.
So you mentioned before that, I believe you said you're in Cleveland, you went to school here in Ohio, and then you moved to Chicago. Did I hear that right? And then you moved back. Talk us through kind of what was the initial catalyst for moving away from Cleveland and what was the catalyst for coming back?
So the catalyst, I guess, for moving away initially was the idea of, that was about the time that I was involved in security selection and I was involved in some portfolio management too. I had the chance to join a much larger firm that was really, I guess, focused on more of the long lines of institutional asset management in the sense that they had many clients that were institutions, a lot of pension plans, and performance was really a focal point there. So it really kind of caused me to up my game a little bit. And again, as I kind of referenced earlier, that was the point that I realized that, frankly, there's some really skilled people in the world of security selection. And I think you've had many of those people on your podcast, to say the least. But I was also really blessed and kind of maybe lucky in the sense that when I made that move to Chicago, I was introduced to several people that really were focused on hedge fund. And again, thinking about hedge funds, and maybe that's kind of an evil word these days, but at the time, it was kind of the golden era for hedge funds. Again, this would probably be in the early 2000s or so. And I think that was kind of something that really opened my eyes around just how big this asset management business is. So that was, I think, maybe kind of an accident that really happened in a really great way in the sense that it turned me on to other ideas and really other people in the investment business. And from that, it allowed me to kind of leverage those skills and essentially being recruited back to Cleveland by the firm that's now known as Clearstead. At the time, it was Heartland Company. And we were focused on institutional investors trying to develop their portfolios around alongside alternative strategies and incorporating hedge funds into their portfolios where appropriate. And thinking also about maybe broadening out asset allocation beyond just stocks and bonds.
Sure. Okay, so you're sitting at this firm in Chicago. You're an equity research analyst, I believe you mentioned. you see every day there's people that are good at maybe you're thinking to yourself, you're not as good and maybe you want to take your career somewhere else. How do you take a step back? Maybe you didn't even think about it. Maybe it was hindsight, but for someone maybe early in their career that is trying to evaluate, hey, is this the career path that I want to go down? How do you kind of evaluate and see like, am I really, really good at this? Or should I go a little bit different direction? Or is it just maybe interest take direction? How did you think about that maybe at the time? And if it is hindsight?
I think that the idea of maybe taking risks early in your career is not a bad thing. And I took a calculated risk. I mean, right, I didn't completely abandon the whole finance industry. I didn't make a complete career change to something different. But the idea of really meeting new people, being exposed to new ideas, I was working for a guy that was very open-minded about how the world was operating at that time. And he really encouraged me to meet other people as well. So it was maybe dumb luck to some extent. But I guess my passion was kind of focused more on top-down views of things as opposed to bottom-up. And that seemed to kind of align with where Heartland at the time, now Clearstead, was going for some of their clients. I talked to a number of other people that were in the institutional investment community to understand how that business worked and understand the nature of the job, so to speak. And those things, they kind of checked a lot of boxes, frankly.
Sure. Now, from the personal side, did you always want to come back to Cleveland or were you open to staying away for a little while longer?
I was open to it for sure. I mean, Chicago is a great city. We had great neighbors, great neighborhood, and really liked our time there. Cleveland has always felt like home. So I think there was a gravitational pull of sorts that brought me back because I think this is also a very special place. But it really wasn't something that was preordained. And it did happen, I guess, at the right time and for the right reasons.
Sure. You mentioned some of your experience lies in hedge funds. How did you start to navigate to that world, or maybe that world attracted you? What was the reason for your career kind of drifting in that direction around that time?
Well, I was fortunate to meet a person who was leaving a large endowment at the time, and he was starting up his own firm, frankly, focused on hedge funds. So at the time where fund of funds were attracting a lot of interest and a lot of assets, that's since waned a little bit. But I think he was also into the world of experimentation and really introduced me to some really great thinkers around portfolio management, security selection, and really the overall idea of having a very performance-minded approach when it came to investing. Not to say that we weren't investment-focused or performance-focused in other roles, but it was just a much higher level, frankly, and a much different type of muscle that those firms were working. And I think the idea to be more flexible in their approach, thinking about even just shorting the stock, for example, that sounds probably pretty prosaic today to talk about that as a new thing. And it wasn't new then, but the idea for me anyway, to be exposed to how shorting a stock can be very complicated and very, very nuanced was really quite intriguing. We also were involved with a number of event-driven strategies managers, a number of different credit managers, and how they expressed their view and understanding some of the really intricate details around a particular security, I think was just fascinating. So it really opened my eyes up to a much broader world within investment management, and being less constrained, if you will, I think was really quite eye-opening.
It sounds like you've been a part of several organizations where you maybe were either in charge of or a part of quite a bit of change. You kind of mentioned the Clearstead and Cleveland Clinic. It sounds like with Clearstead that you kind of helped them navigate the world of hedge funds and maybe alternatives. And tell me if I'm wrong in that classification, but how did you do that? What were your keys there to helping that organization, maybe others, start to dabble maybe more into the alternative investment or hedge fund kind of world?
Well, at the time when I joined Heartland, I think they were already on their way through some great work that Tom Heartland was doing. People like Jay Morgan, Brian Rayback, other people that were there who preceded me, they were already starting down that path of using these things called alternative assets, right? Alternative investments, I guess, is the world likes to call them. And I think the flywheel kind of kicked in is the idea at the same time that Tom and everybody were thinking about diversifying the business perhaps away from pension clients and into more endowment foundations. And traditionally, endowments and foundations are a bit more, I guess for lack of a better term, maybe a bit more nimble, a bit more forward thinking with respect to overall portfolio construction. And so those ideas kind of meshed. And I really gravitated towards the endowment and foundation world and thinking about nonprofits, thinking about how nonprofits could be a bit more unconstrained with their respect to portfolio construction. So it all kind of lined up fairly well in that sense that, you know, the business was kind of moving that direction. The investment industry was moving in that direction. The firm I was working for at the time was also moving in that direction. So maybe again, by accident, but I think the stars somewhat aligned. And by being in the good place where I was working previously with this firm in Chicago, where my boss at the time was very open to kind of let me think freely and maybe recognizing that I had other aspirations than just picking stocks. And again, I'm not dismissing that at all. But the idea to be a little bit courageous and more open-minded about things, all those things just kind of lined up in a really great way for me.
What are some of the, what you see as the keys to success for an organization that maybe hasn't done a lot in alts and hedge funds and whatnot, and maybe is thinking about going in that direction? I'm sure there's some organizations out there that have had success at it and some that like get a little frustrated. What are the keys if an organization wants to move that way?
Well, I think it's important to do your homework. And you're right to kind of point out that there has been some setbacks there. And hedge funds probably have disappointed people over the last several years. And frankly, because the equity markets, as we know it, the S&P 500 has been almost a one-way up kind of trade for the last several years. We've had a couple of big pullbacks along the way. But anything that really wasn't exposed to the overall market in a big way probably underperformed. Hedge funds took in a lot of capital, maybe as an asset class took in too much capital. Fees were probably too high. And so there has been a sorting out of hedge funds. And frankly, some have closed. So I think if people are skeptical around hedge funds with good reason, they probably should be. That said, I do think there are benefits to broadening your definition around portfolio construction, maybe almost kind of taking labels away and maybe thinking about things instead of alternative assets or alternative investments, which in my mind is a term that gets misused. I think people use that term incorrectly, or maybe they have an emotional reaction to that term, alternative investments. Maybe they're excited about it. Maybe they eschew the idea because they're very concerned about something that's not traditional, if you will. So I think if you think about kind of the elements of a portfolio, you think of the elements of an asset management firm or really the overall approach to way a firm manages money, at the end of the day, you're left with certain exposures. And maybe those exposures can be calibrated around the overall risk of your portfolio. So how much beta, for example, is in one hedge fund's portfolio would be vastly different from another hedge fund portfolio. So it's important to really peel away a number of the layers of onion when you think about alternatives, when you think about hedge funds, and you think about other asset classes. But at the end of the day, you're left with some maybe derivative around equity risk. And that's probably the more important thing that people should think about when they use these tools called alternative assets, right? How much equity risk is in your portfolio at the end of the day will probably determine your outcome on a long-term basis. And that's what I think is really what people, they don't get wrong, but they maybe miss that point a little bit. So if you can think about the overall risk in your portfolio, whether it's pure beta, maybe it's some kind of hedge beta, or maybe it's maybe high octane beta, take your pick, but you have to decide what's right for you.
Sure. And kind of building on that, Clearset or Heartland at the time and Cleveland Clinic, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong in this, more kind of foundation endowment kind of model. And now you work for Key, which is a large bank, maybe a little bit more wealth management. The implementation of those alternative assets, compare and contrast kind of what you guys do at Key with maybe what you've done in the past and how they're maybe similar and different.
Well, I think what I've kind of learned later in life is the idea that everybody has to design a portfolio that's right for them. And that's really true whether or not you're talking about a pension plan, an endowment and foundation, or an individual, right? I think it's important to really identify what is the appropriate risk tolerance that you're willing to accept. And you can kind of go from there, and there's a lot of ways you can make that a much more complex exercise. But I think at the core is really designing a portfolio that can accommodate your tolerance for risk. Hopefully there's advisors that can help you navigate that, because I think sometimes there's a psychological tug in certain directions, maybe that are probably somewhat harmful at the wrong time. But if you can set a north course focused on your overall objectives, I think that's applicable whether or not you're talking about individuals or families or pension retirement plans or foundations and endowments. So I think that's our North Star.
Turning to kind of your organization right now and Key, what are some of the top priorities of your research staff right now?
Well, we're obviously navigating a pretty interesting environment with inflation, right? So we're thinking about how do we manage fixed income portfolios in that environment? How much duration is appropriate? We don't take big bets on duration, but it is something that we think about quite a bit. There are people on our team who think about individual security selection decisions and make those in a very nimble, adept way. So it's thinking about that very from a bottom-up perspective. The idea also thinking about how to broaden a portfolio and maybe widen the overall toolkit when you think about inflation protection investments in this environment. How do you incorporate, for example, real assets in an appropriate, balanced way? How do you think about the overall view that the world probably is slowing to some extent and ever changing? And so again, I think it comes back to the idea of designing a portfolio that's really right for each client one at a time is probably the best way to think about the current environment.
Sounds like you guys may have the view that inflation is going to be a little bit stickier than, hey, we're getting back to 2%. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is. Yeah, it is. We've had a view for a while now, Matt, that inflation will probably be high for longer. Not to say it's going to be much higher for longer. I do think it's coming down. And we take the view that maybe this is kind of a transition to the old normal, if you will. And maybe where people were captured by the notion that inflation was called 0 to 2% following the great financial crisis of 2008, where rates were kept at zero for a long time. I think that idea needs to be discarded, frankly, and put off on the shelf for a while. And instead, we think inflation is probably more likely in the 2-4% range as opposed to 0-2%. So that doesn't mean it's bad for risk assets. It maybe does suggest that maybe there's a bit more volatility in the market. Maybe I think it also suggests that the high multiple days, if you will, of 2021 are probably behind us. You have to be more selective when you think about putting capital to work. And I also think it probably provides maybe a bit of a tailwind for active management, where you're seeing more dispersion amongst companies, amongst stocks, and even amongst strategies. And so for that reason, you have to be very focused on what you do. And I think, again, oftentimes we talk about passive has a role in a portfolio, active has a role in a portfolio too. But I think this is an environment maybe where really talented, skilled active managers can add a lot of value.
Sure. What do you think is driving that higher inflation? Like, what happened during the pandemic, or maybe what's happening now to keep it in that 2-4% range as opposed to the 0-2% range that we saw after the global financial crisis?
Well, we think it really is the aftermath of COVID and the policies that were put in place to address that in 2020. And in our view, this is very analogous to what happened after World War II, where there was a lot of pent-up demand that resulted in high inflation. And frankly, there's higher inflation because there's frankly a lot of capital in the economy still. There's frankly a lot of money in the system that is still being worked off. That was provided by monetary authorities, fiscal authorities, and that's going to be with us for quite some time. And based on the current information, we're still seeing wages stay at a pretty heavy rate, and that's actually providing income. So the economy is still digesting and essentially kind of managing through this surplus and this tremendous stimulus that was put forth. And frankly, that's kind of probably likely to be with us for a while longer. Consumers like to spend. I mean, consumers like to consume, I guess, if you will. And that's going to be with us for a while as well. So the propensity to spend is, in our view, likely to persist a bit longer. I think if you start to see companies really start to pull back, maybe that does suggest that employment will probably rise at some point, as it inevitably does. But for right now, we're not seeing that. And so the overall notion that economy is doing pretty well, labor markets are still pretty tight, wages are pretty healthy, and consumers are spending.
What are the top questions, maybe besides inflation, that some of your wealth managers or more client-facing people, what are they coming to your investment office with? What are kind of the top questions?
Well, that's a great question by itself, Matt. So thanks for that. I think sure. The question that people are starting to think about is the election and what does that mean for their portfolio? What does that mean for the economy? I think cable news is definitely the pitch around the election is going to start heating up. It already is at a fevered pitch, but it's going to continue probably, as we all know. I mean, it's only so many days to the election day. We know it's coming, right? So that's going to be one thing that people could probably be focused on quite a bit going forward in our view.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I feel like there's quite a few people out there that will be happy when that day in November is done with.
Let's hope so. Yeah, I think you're right. Now, look, I think it's already been the longest election cycle in the sense that we did have a primary season, right? I mean, we kind of knew who the presumptive nominees were even well into, I guess, in January, February. So we've had the primary season in the season where typically the market kind of trades off a little bit. We didn't have that this time. But now we've got a very long election cycle, it seems like. It's predictable, and to some extent, we know the candidates, right? We've kind of seen these two before. But at the same time, what's going to happen is going to be unpredictable. And clients are justified in being cautious about that. But in my experience, and I'm sure you've got the same reaction, Matt, that I think people often overstate the importance of the elections when it comes to markets, right? I think people oftentimes cloud their investment views with their political views. And not to say you can't have political views. I mean, that's important for everybody to have an opinion on something. But when you have your election views and your political views overshadow your investment views, sometimes you make a mistake. And I would really try to urge people not to do that.
Sure. It'll be interesting after that day in November, what happens to the market. I mean, going back to, I think it was 2016 when Hillary and Trump wins and the market kind of takes off that last 6 weeks or so of the year. I thought that was fascinating. I wonder if the market does that, whether either candidate wins, but I think it'll be interesting what the market does after that, regardless of who is actually going to win.
I agree with you, but I think Steve Haight, who's a key member of our team and does a great job managing our equity portfolios for us, often reminds me and reminds our clients that the markets don't care. They really don't care if it's the red team or the blue team. They just like clarity. So almost all things equal. So long as we have an outcome come November 5th or 6th or whatever the date is, I think markets will probably just breathe a sigh of relief to your point earlier. So markets are not rooting for one team or the other. They want clarity.
Sure. I think all of us in the investment world would love if the market took off after that day so we can end the year higher than we started. Thinking about your guys' asset allocation now relative to a year ago, what's been the one or two biggest changes that you all have made in the asset allocation?
We honestly haven't made that big of a change. And people wonder if we should be making more changes. But sometimes I think the temptation to do something can also be more harmful than doing something. So sometimes it's better just to sit there, frankly. Not to say that we're uninvested or uninterested, but I think sometimes you can make too much change for the sake of making change. But in our view, we've talked a little bit about and maybe leaning a little bit against the Mag 7 trade, if you will. So we're probably a little bit underweight some of those names and some of that part of the market. We're probably a little bit more exposed to small caps, although we've been wrong about that. But we do think that there's probably better value in that part of the market. We still like U.S. assets over international markets, and that's been rewarding. And even in fixed income, I think the idea of focusing on quality securities in this environment makes a ton of sense. So we've occasionally looked at maybe extending duration a little bit. We did so when I think the 10-year broke about 5% last year, and that was beneficial for the first few months. And it's no longer been the case. It's been a bit of a headwind, frankly. But we're not making big bets, so I don't want to overemphasize that as well. Where I think we've also been positioning some of our clients' portfolios is, again, think about other assets beyond stocks and bonds. And we have this notion of, we call these things new tools. So maybe we can expand your toolkit with respect to portfolio construction, whether that be alternatives we talked about, whether that be maybe private equity or even real assets in an environment like this, I think provide some value. To be clear, we're not taking bigger bets there either. So we're not advocating that you have 40% of your portfolio sitting in gold. That would not be the thing we would recommend doing. But at the margin, having a really fully diversified portfolio in this environment where, frankly, the probabilities or maybe the outcomes and the band of those outcomes is probably pretty wide, it makes sense in order to be really fully diversified going forward.
Maybe turning a little bit to outside of work, given your role and your experience, are you involved in any boards or volunteering? And love to hear a little bit more about if you do any work outside of Key.
I do. And I think that's an important thing to note. And I appreciate the question, Matt. And I think Cleveland's actually really blessed with opportunities like that. So whether you're starting your career and you're just beginning to kind of set forward, or you're maybe in the midpoint of your career or somewhat later, Cleveland is really fortunate in the sense that there's a high level of civic engagement. And there's also access to those opportunities too, where I remember my father again and my mother was very civically involved, you know, and at a kind of young age, I guess, even in my career, by given opportunities to serve on advisory boards even or committees before you get to the big board table, if you will, where somebody in their 20s and 30s was really awesome. And so that's kind of continued with me. I'm involved in a couple of nonprofits. Some are focused on healthcare. Another one's focused on retention and attraction for young professionals to stay and live in Cleveland. And those have been really interesting in the sense you meet just tons of people, you're exposed to new facets of the community, and things that are happening right outside your front door are really quite eye-opening. So I think those things are pretty exciting that I really encourage anybody to take advantage of.
Yeah, that's great advice. Not that I am to that point in my career yet where I'm on the big boy boards, if you will, but it is nice being on board and see how they work at a younger age and just to get the feel for it. So completely agree. Maybe turning to personal life, where do some of your passions lie in your personal life to the extent you're willing to share with the audience?
Well, my wife and I are blessed to have two young men as sons. One's a sophomore in college, another one's a junior in high school. So our focus has been on them for the past 20 solid years now. And that really keeps us going. And it's been a big source of inspiration for me, watching them grow up to be hopefully fine young men and really kind of set the world on fire as they make their way.
And I think we've reached the point in the podcast that I think is many people's favorites, a rapid fire lightning round, a little more lighthearted questions. If you're okay with that, we can get started there.
Go for it.
Do you have a nickname?
I don't. I really don't. I had maybe a nickname that lasted for a minute or two in high school, but it never really stuck.
Sure. Favorite hobby?
Favorite hobby. I mean, I really enjoy just talking to people about investments and talking about kind of what's happened in the world. Current events is really quite interesting. Love reading. I like reading history. I'm not really a big fan of fiction, but I really prefer nonfiction. Music's a big part of my life too, and really have an eclectic taste when it comes to music, but really like all types of music.
If you're a cook, what's your favorite recipe to cook?
Well, my wife's a great cook, and so I just kind of stay out of her way most of the time, but we like to try and cook together. There's a lot of things we like to make, frankly, but we're big fans of fish. There's often this time of year where we like to throw things on the grill and kind of experiment with things like that. So I don't know if I've got a favorite type of cuisine, but generally kind of fish, chicken, those kind of things are really top of mind.
Favorite book about investing or finance?
Well, I mentioned Dave Swenson's book that really was, I think, a seminal book that I read when it was first published. And I kind of read parts of it every year, actually. I'm also a big fan of Charlie Ellis, and he's written a lot of great investment essays and books over time. But those people that are even just kind of starting out, he wrote a book called The Elements of Investing, which is a very simplistic, maybe overly simplistic view of how people should think about investments. But I'm frankly a big fan of Charlie's. I had a chance to meet him a few times in my career. And just a remarkable man, how he thinks about the world. And also his book on investment policy. And I guess Winning the Loser's Game was also really interesting for me to read at early age also. So I think Charlie Ellis, Dave Swenson, people like that really were inspirational to me.
What profession would you be in if you weren't in your current profession?
I think I'd probably be a teacher. Probably teaching at the high school, college level would be pretty interesting.
History as a subject, probably?
History or economics. Again, I don't profess to be an economist, but I think that would be interesting for me to get involved with somehow.
What's at the top of your travel destination list, kind of a bucket list travel destination?
Well, there's a lot of the world that we would love to see. I think one thing that we're considering doing is my wife and I have been married 25 years this year. And as part of our honeymoon, we spent a lot of time on the West Coast. And so we're likely to revisit that part of the country come the summer.
Yeah. Well, congrats on the 25 years. That sounds great.
Thank you.
Any hidden talents?
I wouldn't call it a talent, but as I mentioned, music's been a big part of my life. I mentioned my dad already, but my mom is a very accomplished musician. And she turned me on to really the idea of performing on stage and having the presence to do that. So I played the piano for a number of years, and that's something I still enjoy doing.
Favorite lunch spot in Cleveland?
Unfortunately, I think that the place closed, and it was more of a dinner spot, but there was a place called Parallax in Ohio City that we used to love. And unfortunately, that did close, but I've heard rumors that they might be reopening.
Most memorable Cleveland sports moment?
Good or bad?
Both. One of each.
Well, I do remember seeing LeBron leave Cleveland for the first time, and my son at the time was a pretty young guy, and it really hit him pretty hard. So seeing that through his eyes and not really understanding kind of free agency and those things was pretty jarring. So that was kind of a shock, and I hate to see that kind of happen, but that's kind of the way that professional sports works these days. But on the flip side, when he came back, my son was equally impressed and just gratified when we won the championship in 2016. And a close second is seeing the Browns turn themselves around over the past several years. So I think it's Cavs, Browns, Guardians. We're not partisan when it comes to Cleveland sports. We support them all. But those are a couple of big moments in my life.
Sure. I think we're all hoping that the Browns could put together back-to-back playoff runs this year and keep it going. That was pretty fun last year.
That would be great.
Well, George, that is all my questions for you on the hot seat or rapid-fire questions. So appreciate you answering those. And we really appreciate you coming on the podcast and telling us about your long and storied career and sharing some insights. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Matt. It was a ton of fun. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Guardians of Finance, brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head on over to guardiansoffinance.com, where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland, attend an educational or social event, and find volunteer opportunities. Thanks, and we'll see you next time on Guardians of Finance.